Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so very much. Regina, I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, highlights from the 2023 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting, with a theme of partnering with patients, the cornerstone of cancer care and research. And today's program is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Novartis Oncology, and Mirati Therapeutics, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. And this is part one of a two-part series, and there will be another part to this program as well. And I want to just remind all of you that we have a lot of you on the call today. There's over 225 participants on the call today. You come from all of the United States, from both rural, urban, and suburban areas of this country and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Ireland, Lithuania, Nigeria, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And it's really my great pleasure now to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Kamal Abu Hussein. And Dr. Hussein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Department of Breast Medical Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center, co-director of the Janet Knowles Breast Cancer Program, director of Breast Cancer Clinical Trials, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. And Dr. Hussein will be addressing overview of ASCO's 2023 theme, Partnering with Patients, the Cornerstone of Cancer Care and Research, and he'll also be addressing updates on the treatment of breast cancer presented at ASCO. It's really now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hussein.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, for allowing me to discuss the updates on breast cancer in the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting this year. I think the theme of the conference was stressing on the fact that partnering with our patients is the cornerstone of advancing cancer care. So in my discussion, I'm going to focus mainly on the presentations that were most clinically relevant. To start off with the early stage breast cancer, and when I say early stage, this means the curable breast cancer, we're going to focus on the NATALEE clinical trial. This is a trial that's looked at the use of one of the drugs called ribociclib, which is one of the CDK4/6 inhibitors in the setting of early stage high-risk hormone receptor positive breast cancer. Previously, we do have good data from the use of another CDK4/6 inhibitor, the abemaciclib, which was approved in this space based on the results of the MONARCH clinical trial. This is a trial that took patients with four or more positive lymph nodes or one to three positive lymph nodes with an additional risk factor, and they showed that the addition of abemaciclib did decrease the risk of recurrence. The NATALEE trial did include patients who had also lymph node positive disease. They could have had any number of lymph nodes, four or more, or one to three positive lymph nodes, but also patients that did not have lymph node positive disease, provided that they had more than 2 centimeters of cancer and additional risk factors. It could be a high grade, a high proliferation index, or a genomic test. So tests like mammoprint or Oncotype with a high risk, and it treated those patients with either ribociclib plus adjuvant endocrine therapy or adjuvant endocrine therapy alone. Now here, with the use of ribociclib, they did report a 25% reduction in the risk of breast cancer recurrence when the ribociclib was added, and this was used in the trial for a total of 3 years. The abemaciclib in the MONARCH trial was used for 3 years, and it did show an initial benefit of 2.8%, and that benefit kept getting wider and wider up to 6.4% at 4 years. The NATALEE trials did show a comparable benefit, and it's really a healthy thing that we do have options in the setting of early-stage high-risk disease with different durations of use, different side effects, and so forth. So now we did mention the MONARCH trial, which looked at early-stage hormone receptor-positive breast cancers with high-risk features that were treated with 2 years of abemaciclib. There was an analysis presented that explored the benefit in the elderly population. They defined elderly as above the age of 65, and it seems that they derived the same benefit as younger patients. So it was good confirmation telling us that there is no reason to shy away from treating our elderly folks with breast cancer exactly the same way that we would treat our younger patients. They also showed us that despite patients above the age of 65 having the same rate of side effects as younger ones, but they were more likely to have those reductions. This is probably because of the investigating physicians being a little more sensitive to elderly patients having any form of side effects than our younger folks, which is very true of how we practice. But what was nice to see was that regardless of those reductions in dosage, the outcome was identical to patients who were treated with the full dose of the medication, which is very important and a helpful piece of information telling us that when we sometimes need to dose reduce because of side effects, it should not make us think that it would impact the overall benefit from the drug. Another very important presentation that I would like to mention is a meta-analysis of a large number of patients. I think it studied more than 15,000 patients, addressing the question about whether or not ovarian function suppression was beneficial, and the resounding answer really was yes. Offering ovarian function suppression does reduce the risk of recurrence and death by about 18%. This form of therapy, ovarian function suppression, does come with side effects for some patients, and so we think that the magnitude of benefit that was mentioned in this meta-analysis is a strong indication to consider that, and it should be a consideration and a discussion between the physician and the young patients that are being treated for breast cancer. So now I think it's a good thing to say that we have multiple layers available for our young patients with breast cancer to decrease risk of recurrence, including the use of aromatase inhibitors, ovarian function suppression, and now we have more than one CDK4/6 inhibitor available in that field. The important thing to remember from this meta-analysis was that not only did it reduce the risk of breast cancer recurrence and death, but there was also no increase in other causes of mortality because of the use of ovarian function suppression. So I think when we think about offering ovarian function suppression, we were always worried about risk of cardiovascular side effects and other ill health effects, but thankfully we did not see any cause for increased mortality from offering ovarian function suppression. There was also a poster that explored the time of the day that people take their medications and how it intersects with the effect of the drug because of the complex hormonal environment in our body. And that poster showed that there are really no differences in regards to the time that aromatase inhibitors are taken and the benefit that should be garnished from their use. But it did show that patients taking tamoxifen at night have a better outcome than patients taking tamoxifen in the morning. So it's a simple switch, and I started talking to all of my patients on tamoxifen to try to take their medication at nighttime. One thing that's a very exciting topic really in the world of breast cancer is the concept of antibody drug conjugates, and those are molecules that are made after they identify a surface marker on the surface of the cancer cell, and an antibody is designed against that surface marker, and this antibody is attached to a chemotherapy particle. The attachment happens through a linker. So once this compound attaches itself to the surface marker of the cancer cell, it does release the chemotherapy inside the cancer cell, leading to the killing of the cell from within. We've seen a lot of antibody drug conjugates in the last few years, including Kadcyla, Sacituzumab govitecan, also known as Trodelvy, Trastuzumab deruxtecan, known as Enhertu. And we have a lot of good and promising results regarding one that's still in development called Dato-DXd. In this presentation, they explored another antibody-drug conjugate called Patritumab deruxtecan, also known as HER3-DXd, which seemed to offer benefit for people diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. So about 60 to 70% of breast cancer patients express this HER3 protein. The study results showed that the HER3-DXd offered benefits, including shrinking the cancer, for a variety of metastatic breast cancers that had grown while being treated with other medicines. Cancer types included in the study were hormone receptor positive, triple negative, and HER2 low cancers. And it seems to be very well tolerated, with low-grade nausea, fatigue, diarrhea, and vomiting being the most common side effects. Now, synchronously with the survivorship presentations were happening at the same time as the breast cancer presentations. And there was one presentation that was very important and potentially practice-changing, and that has to do with an oral chemotherapy agent called capecitabine, or also known as Zoloda. This is a medication that is widely used in the breast cancer community for some patients in the early-stage setting and many patients in the metastatic setting. And one of the most important side effects for this agent is called hand-foot syndrome. And that means redness, swelling, and blistering on the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet that can happen as a side effect from the medication. And this presentation looked at the application of a topical gel called diclofenac, also known as Voltaren, which is a pain medication. And it is applied in a form of a gel, and it seems to significantly decrease the risk of hand-foot syndrome for patients that applied that to the affected areas. So hopefully this discussion will help our audience understand some of the advances that are ready for use in the clinic and others that are still under investigation. Some of those steps are small, others are large, but they're really all moving toward the same goal of advancing the systemic therapies available for our patients. Hopefully that can offer our patients with breast cancer a better level of care. Thank you so much, Dr. Mesner.
Hussein, that was a superb presentation, very informative for all of our breast cancer patients listening to the call today, and I so appreciate the information you presented that was presented at ASCO. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Carolyn Ronowitz. And Dr. Ronowitz is professor, obstetrics and gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine, recipient of ASCO Hologic Mentor Award. And Dr. Ronowitz will be addressing updates on the treatment of ovarian cancer presented at ASCO and the role of clinical trials, how research increases treatment options. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ronowitz.
Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you for including me in this important conference call. I'm honored to be among this prominent group of well-informed and very articulate oncologists. In addition to the charge of reviewing ASCO, I also went to other meetings that are not as large but very important, and that was SGO, the Society of Gynecologic Oncology, and ESMO, the European Society of Medical Oncology. Impressive advances in the therapeutic armamentarium have occurred in the management of ovarian cancer. These meetings demonstrated that much progress has been made in ovarian cancer research and the introduction of several new treatments, which look very promising. There were practice-changing presentations. Maintenance strategies in advanced ovarian cancer continue to evolve and favorably impact survival of women with ovarian cancer. It is very important that patients ask their physicians, their surgeons, to characterize their tumor with molecular characterizations, because the molecular changes on these cells can be very important in selecting therapy, And there's a new type of trial called the basket trial, where the tumor originates isn't the primary issue, but what molecular changes are on the cancer cell that are similar to other types of cancer, for example, breast cancer, which you just heard, pancreas, colon. And so it's very important that patients make sure that their doctors have done this molecular characterization. They send it out, or some labs in the hospitals are able to provide the studies. The current standard of care for women with BRCA mutations, and again, that's a molecular genetic characterization, or homologous recombinant deficiency, which is a molecular change, is the use of PARP inhibitors with or without bevacizumab following frontline therapy. And I emphasize frontline therapy because there's been a change in the use of PARP inhibitors after developing a recurrence. So some of the exciting new agents that were discussed are the antibody drug conjugates. This is an emerging class of drugs in the treatment of ovarian cancer. They're known as ADCs, antibody drug conjugates, and they are like the Trojan horse. And what I mean by that is that they target a receptor on the ovarian cancer cell, which then allows entry of the active drug. So mirvetuximab is an ADC, which is probably the most studied and out front of all of the ADCs. It targets a folate receptor, which is broadly expressed on ovarian cancer cells. And again, my point about the molecular characterization, patients want to find out if they have the folate receptor because this drug could be then active. The drug is transported once it hooks onto the folate receptor into the cells. The largest trial so far has been the Mirasol trial, which was a phase 3 trial in platinum-resistant patients. This has traditionally been a very difficult group to treat. They receive the best drugs up front, and then they develop resistance to those drugs. And this study, the Mirasol study, demonstrated an improved progression-free survival and response rates. Other folate receptors, or ADCs, are currently being studied with promising results. Upifitamab is a drug in a trial called UpRi, and that's an ADC target that targets the sodium transporter, sodium pi 2B, which is also broadly expressed in ovarian cancer. And it's a similar strategy as the mirvetuximab, which is they target the receptor to get the active drug into the tumor. However, more recent data did not meet the primary endpoint, the overall response rate, in the phase 1B2 uplift trial in patients with platinum resistance. So I think more data and longer time needs to be followed to figure out where this drug fits in best. Another class of agents are the replication stress inhibitors. These are small molecule inhibitors of WEE1, and they have shown significant clinical response rates in clinical trials. This is clearly a drug worth exploring in clinical trials, and so this is worth watching. A phase 1-2 study of ubamatamab is a MUC16, again, another antigen that's expressed on the cells, and CD3 bispecific antibody directly targeting MUC16, which is expressed in 80 to 90% of patients with ovarian cancer. The responses were seen in patients with high expression of MUC16. So I know I'm repeating myself, but again, molecular characterization is key to efficacy in these trials. Since it's a phase 1-2, this was considered an exploratory pilot study which demonstrated activity and which will now progress to larger trials. In low-grade ovarian cancer, which is not as common as the high-grade variant that most patients with ovarian cancer have. There were several trials. The RAMP 201 was a study that showed promising results of avutometinib plus defactinib in recurrent low-grade ovarian cancer. This was a 45% response rate in those patients with KRAS mutations. So I know I'm harboring on this, but again, it's very important to know the mutations on the tumor to see if you're eligible for some of these trials. GOG-3026, which is a cooperative group study, demonstrated durable responses with ribociclib plus letrozole in low-grade serous ovarian cancer. And the ribociclib is just what you heard in the breast cancer trial. It's a CD4 inhibitor, and it's active in patients who have estrogen receptors on their ovarian cancer. In frontline therapy, there was a phase 3 DUO-O trial. This was durvalumab with paclitaxel, carboplatin, and bevacizumab, followed by maintenance durvalumab, bevacizumab, and olaparib in newly diagnosed ovarian cancer without a tumor mutation of BRCA. This study showed that this regimen resulted in statistically significant and clinically meaningful progression-free survival. Durvalumab, or Imfinzi is the commercial name, is an immunotherapeutic agent. This is an important trial. It is the first phase 3 clinical trial to meet its primary endpoint in ovarian cancer using immunotherapy. Immunotherapy has been disappointing. However, in this combination and in this duo trial, there was definitely clinical and significant improvement in progression-free survival. So that's exciting and shows that there will be promise and use for immunotherapeutic agents in ovarian cancer. In a small study, neoadjuvant olaparib, that's a PARP inhibitor, in patients with a BRCA mutation for 2 cycles, followed by cytoreductive surgery, was feasible. So what in this study that they did was they gave the treatments up front and then brought the patients to surgery, making less radical surgery possible. HIPIC, which is intraperitoneal hypothermia, has been out for a while, and there was a phase 2 trial which reported an improved 10-year overall survival when used in primary debulking or what we call cytoreductive surgery. HIPIC is offered at some centers, not all centers. In recurrent disease, their agent has an Fc-engineered recombinant human immunoglobulin G1 monoclonal anti-CTLA-4 antibody, and it's called botensilimab, in combination with bevacizumab, which is a PD-1 antibody, which induced durable responses in platinum-resistant and platinum-refractory disease in a small study. So again, this is exciting preliminary work about the use of immunotherapy. The phase 3 Artistry 77 trial is planned to combine pembrolizumab and nevalucan alpha, which is a stable fusion protein, with IL-2 immunosuppressive and immunostimulatory functions. Previous studies in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer have demonstrated a response rate of only 29%, but clinically important disease control rate of greater than 70%. The NOVA final analysis, a phase 3 randomized trial, did not confirm a significant overall survival for maintenance niraparib in recurrent platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer. This has practice-changing implications and really brings into question the role of PARP inhibitors in the recurrent setting as opposed to clearly benefit in the primary setting. A phase 2 study of relacorilant, which is a selective glucocorticoid receptor modulator, in combination with nab-paclitaxel, was given in recurrent platinum-resistant refractory ovarian cancer treated with less than 4 prior therapies, so a heavily treated group. And that has shown that intermittent administration of the relacorilant and the nab-paclitaxel showed an improved progression-free survival, duration of response, and overall survival. However, based on protocol pre-specified multiplicity adjustment, the primary endpoint did not reach statistical significance. However, this is clinically an important trial, and we'll see more of this drug. As a matter of fact, a phase 3 trial is underway. So to conclude of these meetings, I think we are seeing exciting practice-changing presentations, and it's important for our patients. I remember when I first started out, the only drug we had was platinum. So I am encouraged over my career to see all of these changes. So I strongly encourage all of our patients, and specifically those with ovarian cancer, to avail themselves of the clinical trials before they receive too many standard therapies. In my opinion, the advances and excitement at these meetings were in drugs in development, as I've briefly gone over in this teleconference. There are regional, national, and international trials. I cannot overstate the importance of clinical trials in getting new and exciting therapies to our patients. Clinical trials can be found at clinicaltrials.gov. In a recent call with the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance, we were joined by 11 pharmaceutical companies to discuss their pipeline of drugs in ovarian cancer. The clinical trials have some of the newer agents discussed in this presentation and will be used in future trials. They're looking at other novel therapies, including a CART T-cell clinical trial in ovarian cancer. So before embarking on future therapies, it is wise to explore this website, again, clinicaltrials.gov, to assess new trials. Many are available at sites throughout the U.S. Thank you for your attention, and I turn this back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was a superb presentation, and I imagine that the ovarian cancer community is just so thrilled to hear about all of the new treatments that are available, all the clinical trials that are available, and all the new information that's available, and the need for them to really be actively working with their physicians with the information they learned today, and to also participate in clinical trials. So it's really important. The treatment of today is based on the clinical trials of yesterday, or sometimes not that far off. And often these trials are, you get a treatment that's available before it would be available publicly. So thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is an attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to be addressing updates on the treatment of prostate cancer presented at ASCO and talking with your healthcare team about your treatment choices. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and welcome to our listeners. It's always a treat to have the opportunity to give an update in the world of prostate cancer. There is no question that nowadays patients are very well informed. They come to clinic sometimes knowing some of the data before I even have the opportunity to review it through a journal. And it's always a treat to at least try to explain the pros and cons of a particular treatment to a patient and make sure they understand whether the drug or drugs are relevant to their cancer. So at this year's American Society for Clinical Oncology, there were several themes, and the three that I picked out is, number one, changes to standard or emerging therapies. In other words, how do we build or improve on some of the therapies that we have within a particular treatment space? And I'll explain that in a moment. The second is targeting the DNA repair mechanism of the cancer cell. How do we stop the cancer cell from growing? And are there ways of attacking the mechanism by which the DNA keeps getting repaired within the cancer cell? And thirdly, capitalizing on a marker that many of you already know about, known as prostate-specific membrane antigen, or PSMA, as a treatment modality, and how do we build on that? So without further ado, let me start off by talking about patients who are newly diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer. That's disease that has spread beyond the confines of the prostate and may or may not be in either the lymph nodes or bones or both. Now, we have at least to date 7 different treatments. It's really amazing, but keeping in mind that the platform on which all these treatments are built happens to be the use of hormonal therapy, or as we prefer to call it, androgen deprivation therapy, or ADT. Now, ADT encompasses a wide variety of different injections. For example, many of you are aware of Leuprolide or Gorceralin or even Relugolix. But in addition to that being used as a single agent in a particular clinical circumstance, we have found that we can improve upon the use of just hormonal therapy alone by the addition of several oral drugs that have been around now probably for several years. They're called the androgen receptor signaling inhibitors, and they include abiraterone, otherwise known as Zytiga, so that's A-B-I-R-A-T-E-R-O-N-E. The other is enzalutamide, E-N-Z-A-L-U. T-A-M-I-D-E. The other name for that is Xtandi, X-T-A-N-D-I. And then there is apalutamide, A-P-A-L-U-T-A-M-I-D-E. The other name for that is Erleada, E-R-L-E-A-D-A. Now, all those drugs have excellent profiles in terms of tolerability, but when given with androgen deprivation therapy, have been shown to improve quality of life in addition to a variety of different benefits that any patient with prostate cancer would want to have. So that's been literally what's been going on. Now, what about if we did chemotherapy? Well, we have enough data that's been published to show that adding chemotherapy to androgen deprivation therapy also improves quality of life and a variety of other measures that are incorporated, and that also seems to be very beneficial for patients who have a higher tumor burden, meaning greater than 4 metastatic lesions. But more importantly, and these are really options 6 and 7, is the addition of chemotherapy, which the standard of care being docetaxel or Taxotere, has now been added to not only androgen deprivation therapy, but the drug abiraterone, and has also been added to another androgen receptor signaling inhibitor called darolutamide. Now, what is particularly exciting is that, number one, we have 7 treatments for patients who have brand new metastatic disease, and more importantly, the addition of chemotherapy to those hormone pills, if you will, as well as the hormone injections, seem to be part of what we would now call treatment or dose intensification, meaning that for some patients, the addition and the combination of these drugs together seems to be more beneficial than either drug alone. And it seems to not only improve quality of life for patients who have very high tumor burdens or very aggressive cancers or perhaps are symptomatic as compared with any of the single treatments alone. Now, this is something, of course, that is not for every patient. And here's where it is very important that when you're speaking with your doctor and knowing that these drugs exist, that there are differences among the drugs in terms of potential side effects and interactions with medications that you may be on. So anytime you are meeting with your doctor and you're discussing newly diagnosed disease, it is certainly reasonable to have further discussion in terms of, well, doc, what do you think is better? Should we, you know, put everything into the pot, or should we just keep, you know, one or two ingredients out? And I think it's not something that one can just say, do this or nothing. It does require interaction and discussion and evaluation of other parameters. So we did learn this last ASCO that in terms of patients who are receiving dose intensification, that patients with higher volume disease do very well, but more importantly, you could also add radiation to patients who are also receiving the chemotherapy along with the different androgen receptor signaling inhibitors. And so that is something that is being further investigated to determine just which patients will benefit compared with others. So there's a lot that's still evolving. We are now learning more and more that we can combine drugs very safely and that the potential side effects of low blood counts and extreme fatigue are not as concerning as we thought them to be initially. So more to come, but a lot of excitement there. Similarly, what do we do about the darn cancer cell that continues to grow in spite of what we do? Well, one of the mechanisms of resistance, as many of you know, is our mutations at the site where all these drugs bind, which is called the androgen receptor. But more importantly, within the cancer cell, the cancer is very, I guess the word would be cunning, in the sense that if we give a drug to attack the DNA, that's the sort of the heart of the cell that replicates and makes the cell divide, and you continue to make the cell grow and have more and more other cells. Well, we have, and this is true in ovarian cancer and breast cancer, so we're actually very fortunate, and a chemical that is going to interact and block the ability of that cancer cell's DNA to divide. So all cells have what we call PARP. That's what we, P-A-R-P, it's poly-ADP ribose polymerase. And what it really means is that it is a chemical that repairs broken DNA. So if we give somebody chemotherapy, we give somebody a PARP inhibitor, we do something to destroy the DNA of the cell has this obnoxious habit of wanting to repair itself, and it repairs itself via a chemical, which is what we call PARP, P-A-R-P. We've gotten somewhat clever in the sense that we have now developed inhibitors to PARP. We call them PARP inhibitors. There are several of them. There is they go by a variety of different names. One is called olaparib, O-L-A-P-A-R-I-B. Another one, talazoparib, T-A-L-A-Z-O-P-A-R-I-B. And another one, niraparib, N-I-R-A-P-A-R-I-B. Now, why am I going through the spelling? These are all PARP inhibitors. They have been FDA approved in patients who have genomic abnormalities, particularly in certain genes. These PARP inhibitors vary a little bit in their ability to trap PARP. Some are less aggressive in grabbing the PARP molecule and inhibiting it. Others are a little less, but there have now been three studies that have led to the FDA approval, the Food and Drug Administration approval, that is, of combining the PARP inhibitor with the standard of care hormone drugs, or what we call the androgen receptor signaling inhibitors, such as abiraterone or enzalutamide. The PROPEL, P-R-O-P-E-L trial was the first to show that in patients who have the BRCA2 mutation, so these are patients who on genomic profiling have this alteration that makes them very susceptible to this class of drugs, that the combination of the two is significantly better than either one alone. In fact, this led to the approval of the of this combination not only in the European organization or European Union, I should say, but has also been now broadly accepted in Europe as a standard of care for all patients, irrespective of any sort of genetic or genomic alteration. Another trial also was just discussed and approved by the Food and Drug Administration. It's called Talipro, and that is looking at this other PARP inhibitor, talazoparib, along with a drug you all know called enzalutamide. And this, too, has shown excellent disease control and improvement in a variety of different parameters that have improved quality of life, among others. The Magnitude trial looked at niraparib plus abiraterone in patients who have what we call deleterious BRCA-mutated cancers. So these are patients who may have the BRCA, which is breast cancer, mutation 1 and 2. And just so everybody remembers, men with prostate cancer, about 40% of them may have this mutation, which is something we never knew about before. But there are other mutations that are also thought to be problematic and would respond to these drugs, including ATM, CDK12, CHEK2, FANCA, and PALB2. You can see these if you go to, I believe, Cancer Care's website or the Prostate Cancer Foundation. But the point is, this has led to very, very significant improvement for patients. So all three of these PARP inhibitors have now been approved. Lastly, everybody remembers that we were talking about this last year, prostate-specific membrane antigen as a treatment modality, and this was based on a radioactive compound called lutetium-177 that was attached to a small molecule of PSMA that was essentially circulating through the body to bind to the prostate cancer cell. And this complex was immediately taken into the cell where it was broken apart and the radioactive portion released to kill the cells. So we are trying now to look at a variety of different what we call radioligands. So lutetium is what we call a beta emitter, excuse me. We are looking at other radioactive compounds, including actinium, which is a alpha emitter, and also looking at the combinations of an alpha and a beta emitter and see if two is better than one and whether or not we can demonstrate safety. And that's actually been shown by a group at New York Hospital. So lots of really incredible things that are being done to keep people doing well for many, many years. And hopefully we will continue on this same very productive track. And with that, I thank you for your listening and attending today's call. And back to you, Dr. Messner. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin. That was a superb presentation, really very outstanding, and really covered the whole spectrum of the prostate cancer treatment options for people in terms of what was presented at ASCO, and also giving great detail to everyone. And I really appreciate, also appreciate your giving the detail to everyone so they could really comprehend it, listen to it again, share it with other family members. So thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Slovin. And our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. Dr. Bruce is the Edgar M. Hausbein Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman of Academic Affairs, New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, Director Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory, Co-Director of Brain Tumor Center. And Dr. Bruce will be addressing updates on the treatment of brain cancers presented at ASCO and quality of life concerns. It's a great pleasure for me to bring my esteemed colleague, to introduce my most esteemed colleague, Dr. Bruce, to you.
Hello, everyone. I'm excited to share with you a number of very exciting and novel updates for brain tumor research after the recent ASCO meeting. The 2023 ASCO meeting explored a variety of ongoing clinical trials and promising experimental treatments for brain tumor patients. You probably know currently the standard of care treatment for glioblastoma patients is maximal safe tumor resection followed by 6 weeks of radiation therapy, and then chemotherapy with temozolomide, also known as Temodar. However, tumor recurrence is inevitable, and recurrent tumors are often resistant to the previous treatments. That's why the ASCO meetings are so important. These meetings provide an outlet for brain tumor researchers and clinicians to continue to expand our experimental treatments and clinical trial efforts. At the same time, it gives us an important space for clearly communicating our projects to each other and also how they translate to outcomes for patients with this problem. Now, one of the most exciting areas of glioma research is immunotherapy. To understand how immunotherapy works, think of when you get an infection, such as a virus or bacteria. Your body mounts a vigorous immune response to get rid of that infection. A similar thing happens when patients have tumors. The immune response tries to get rid of the tumor cells because they're seen as foreign invaders like bacteria or viruses. However, the problem is that the immune system is generally not strong enough to overcome the rapidly growing tumor. Also, the tumor cells are clever. They disguise themselves and ultimately will block an immune response that can attack the growing tumor. ASCO has highlighted several immunotherapy strategies in previous years, and many of these projects have continued to accelerate this year. Now, one promising strategy is to heat up these tumors and produce a forceful anti-tumor response. Two groups attempted to do this with T-cell based therapies. Now, T-cells are a type of immune cell that is most likely to be effective at killing tumor cells. A group from Austin, Texas is currently examining the benefit of using a toxin known as chlorotoxin with CAR T-cell therapy for recurrent glioblastomas. This is in a phase one trial starting this year. You've probably heard about CAR T-cells. CAR T-cells are a novel therapy that's designed to change T-cells so that they are more effective at destroying the tumor cells. A group from China conducted a first human phase one trial for recurrent glioblastoma patients with a novel treatment strategy by genetically engineering or changing the T cells. They used a treatment strategy that addresses the immunosuppression by targeting something known as the immune checkpoint, also called PD-1. You've probably heard about PD-1 in the popular press as well. We're eager to see these promising results soon. Now, along those lines, one of the most common treatment strategies presented at ASCO were these immune checkpoint inhibitors. Immunotherapy drugs, especially checkpoint blockers like PD-1 inhibitors, have made significant advances in many types of cancers, as you may have heard, again, in the popular press. And so there's considerable research into these approaches, specifically for glioblastoma. Pembrolizumab is an antibody drug that blocks the PD-1 checkpoint inhibitor, and it's designed to stimulate a more effective immune response. There is a group from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center that's currently enrolling patients in a phase two trial for recurrent glioblastoma, which combines this pembrolizumab drug with temozolomide and another targeted therapy called olaparib. So this is multiple combination therapies and all designed to attack the immune response. They're actively recruiting patients, and we're excited to see the results on this really novel immune combination therapy very soon. Another therapy that targets this PD-1 is the antibody known as nivolumab, which is very similar to that other drug, pembrolizumab. So these are all these are antibodies. The names are hard to say, but they're all designed to block different parts of the immune system. And in a phase 2 trial from the NIH, they found that nivolumab was very well tolerated with some strong efficacy in patients with recurrent IDH mutant gliomas. And interestingly, they're also examining whether there's a clinical benefit as measured by overall survival and by analyzing changes in the immune response. Other groups are uniquely examining if specific therapies can be utilized to strengthen the effect of some of these immune checkpoint inhibitors, especially through combination therapy strategies. Now, a group from the Mayo Clinic is currently running a phase 2 trial with recurrent glioblastoma patients treated with a drug called N2L7. And this drug modifies the immune response. This drug is combined with one of the PD-1 inhibitors, pembrolizumab, to potentially reverse the immune suppression. So they're kind of blocking the immune suppression that occurs. And overall, with the goal of strengthening the effect of these immune checkpoint inhibitors. It's likely that many future immunotherapy drugs will not be delivered as a single therapy, and almost certainly that we're going to need combinations of drugs. Therefore, we're eager to see the results from trials such as this one using drug combinations that are hopefully synergistic. A particularly interesting treatment strategy to mention is immunotherapy that's given prior to radiation therapy after surgery. A group from Santa Monica, California, completed the first study using the checkpoint blockade therapy for newly diagnosed glioblastoma patients prior to standard radiotherapy. So for a newly diagnosed patient after their surgery, but before the radiation, they're given this immune drug before radiation, with the idea that maybe radiation would block some of its effects. So it would be more effective if you give it before the radiation. And they found a potential benefit using this combination immunotherapy with two different types of checkpoint inhibitors. And this phase 1 trial is still open, and the investigators are analyzing other study arms, including various other targeted therapies. So there's a lot of, you know, very important and interesting work going on in this area. Another thing I want to highlight from this study is that they also aim to determine how the sequence of immunotherapy drugs affects the anti-tumor response. So it's not just combination therapy, but how you give the combination, like which drug should be given first, which second, because they can have different interrelated effects that way. And this is something that many others are looking at, including our group here at Columbia. We're also interested in this. And this group is attempting to study this by analyzing paired tumor specimens that are taken before and after treatment. So if you get tissue before treatment and after treatment, you can analyze the effects of that. And since gliomas are very heterogeneous and all patients differ in their tumor makeup, it's important to determine how each patient responds to each treatment in order to determine the best treatment options, especially as we enter this era of more personalized approaches. And so in line with this previous work, I want to emphasize the importance of furthering our understanding of just the basic molecular biology of gliomas. And this is becoming more important as we enter this personalized medicine area with more targeted therapies. And this is particularly relevant to one of the clinical trials that has received a lot of attention. It's called the Indigo trial for brain cancer. And this looked at patients with low-grade gliomas who had the IDH mutation. And you may have heard this IDH term before because it's important for glioblastoma. And patients with IDH mutations generally have a better prognosis. most of these tumors start out as low-grade gliomas before they eventually become glioblastomas. And this multicenter trial looked at a drug called vorasidomib, which targets the IDH mutation in these low-grade gliomas. And the idea is to hopefully give this in low-grade gliomas and slow down their time to progression to becoming a glioblastoma, and also delaying the need for radiation and chemotherapy. This study is still being analyzed, but the results are very exciting. Another study arising from the molecular biology analysis involves a group from Japan, which is using computational tools to analyze all of the gene changes in an individual's tumor. And that way, by identifying specific molecular changes, they can come up with therapy that's very much targeted to the patient themselves. Finally, before we end here, I just want to talk a little bit about communicating with your healthcare team. First of all, it's important to seek reputable specialists, and it's helpful to find people who are specialists specifically in brain tumors. It's easier than ever to find these people with the use of the internet, and also by working with support groups like Cancer Care, this can be easily accomplished. It's important to keep in mind that you have some control over your lifestyle, given the inconveniences of seeing doctors and getting tests and treatment. You know, keeping a notebook or using a smartphone to jot down notes and reminders will help to make sure that you're not overwhelmed by dealing with your condition. This way, when you see your doctor, you can make sure your questions are answered and you make sure all your instructions are understood. You also want to make sure that your other healthcare professionals, such as your primary care doctor, are kept informed so they can help coordinate your care. It's important to have an honest dialogue with your family so that they understand what you're going through and can help make these decisions. Also, I would be skeptical of anecdotes, no matter how well-meaning. There are no two patients who are exactly alike, and I would be careful about trying to apply something you've heard about another patient to your specific case. It may also be useful to have second opinions if time is available. Having other opinions can help refine and formulate your questions. Now, it's important to work with your healthcare team and friends and family so that you can maintain the highest quality of life possible. This is very doable. Just because you have a brain tumor, no one's saying that you can't visit the mall or enjoy your birthday party or have a nice meal or see a good movie. It's important to continue to live your life to the highest degree possible, despite any diagnosis and side effects that you may be suffering. This is by far the best way to cope with your tumor. In closing, I would like to strongly advocate for patients to actively participate in clinical trials at academic centers. Across the country, there are many great and strong teams who think about brain tumors all day long. And by joining clinical trials at academic centers, it's a great opportunity to be treated by a team that's going to provide extra attention to you and ensure both you and the trial's success. In closing, I just want to remind you that there's some outstanding laboratories and researchers who are working with glioblastomas and making considerable progress. There is now more optimism for finding better treatments and improving the quality of life than there's ever been before. Thank you for attention. I'll now turn this back over to Carolyn for the next speaker.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was really an outstanding presentation, just wonderful, and both in terms of all the information you provided from ASCO and also in terms of the importance of, for people, and so probably applies to everyone on the call, of living their life as well and doing things that that give meaning and purpose to your life. So I think that's really an important message to give to all of us, plus very inspiring to hear about all the new developments in glioblastoma. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Misikowicz, and Dr. Misikowicz is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology and Medical Oncology, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Clinical Director of Research in Head and Neck, Clinical Director of the Center for Personalized Cancer Therapeutics, the Tisch Cancer Institute, Chairman of the Oncology and Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. Dr. Misikowicz will be addressing updates on the treatment of oral, head, and neck cancer presented at ASCO, and also be talking about the management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Misikowicz.
Thank you for having me. My name is Dr. Krista Misikowicz, and I'm going to be covering the ASCO update about head and neck cancer. Before I'm going to cover the actual abstract and presentation, just a little bit of the background. So head and neck cancer can be divided into nasopharyngeal cancer. This is the one behind our eyes, behind our nose. The oral cancer that includes the oral, tongue, gums, hard palate. Throat cancer or pharyngeal cancer that includes the base of the tongue, tonsil, the back of the throat. And then we have the voice box or laryngeal cancer and hypopharyngeal cancer. So having this in mind, the first part I want to focus on nasopharyngeal cancer, and this is the one that occurs behind our nose or behind our eyes. And the first study that I want to discuss, it comes from China. It was presented at ASCO because as of now, the nasopharyngeal cancer, we call it locally advanced, and what it means that the cancer spread to the lymph nodes, but there is no distant metastasis, is currently being treated with chemotherapy followed by chemotherapy and radiation, or chemotherapy and radiation followed by chemotherapy. And there is this huge debate which kind of chemotherapy combination given before or after radiation is better, because we have quite a few choices. And when we make those choices, we want to make sure that this chemotherapy is not only better in terms of shrinking the cancer or killing the cancer, but we're also interested if this chemotherapy is less or more toxic because we don't want to hurt our patients. And we had two combinations that we're kind of debating, and we were not sure which one is better. The first combination is gemcitabine and cisplatin, and we had a pretty good, I would say, hint or guess that that's going to be the winner, but we didn't have that clear proof. And the other chemotherapy that we're debating, sometimes given to a patient, is platinum 5-FU. So what was done in this study? They took patients with locally advanced nasopharyngeal cancer. All of them, they received chemotherapy and radiation, and they were randomized, meaning we're kind of flipping the coin and deciding in which chemotherapy those patients are going to be receiving. One group of patients, they received gemcitabine and cisplatin, and the other group received platinum and 5-FU. And it was not our surprise, but actually gemcitabine and cisplatin was better. So was better in terms of efficacy, was better in terms of shrinking the cancer, it was better in terms of eliminating the cancer, but it was also better tolerated. So basically this is the winner. So I'm happy because this is something that I still use in my clinical practice, and I was always kind of debating which option between those two is better. So now I have the proof that I was correct. So it's really reinforcing me, and I'm going to continue doing so. The second abstract that I want to discuss, it's also about nasopharyngeal cancer, and it's also about locally advanced, meaning that the cancer spreads to the lymph nodes from the nasopharynx. And in this study, all the patients received gemcitabine and cisplatin, exactly the same regimen that I was discussing a few seconds ago. And what was kind of, I would say, surprising and amazing in this study, because as I mentioned quite a few seconds ago, the current standard says that after gemcitabine cisplatin, all the patients should receive chemotherapy and radiation given concurrently, meaning at the same time. And this is our current standard. And this is not just our standard for just nasopharyngeal cancer. This is our standard for head and neck cancer. It's one of those paradigms or sort of like dogmas that we have in head and neck cancer. But in this study, the scientists, they said, after chemotherapy and radiation, people, they're going to be randomized to chemotherapy and radiation, which is current standard. But what we're going to do as a randomized study, we're going to give just radiation alone. And this is very encouraging because it's really hard to convince I would be giving you less treatment. And there is no difference between radiation alone or chemotherapy and radiation. And what is the benefit of this? The patient can be spared from side effects of chemotherapy when it's given concurrently. I think it's still a little bit too early to say this is going to be the current standard because there are many studies done before that show there is an advantage of adding chemotherapy and radiation, and this study shows something opposite. I think we need more study just to make sure before we're going to apply this paradigm to our clinical practice. But it's still encouraging that we can offer good treatment to our patients. They're going to be effective, but at the same time, they're going to be less toxic. The third abstract, also about nasopharyngeal cancer, I want to discuss about patients for which they have recurrent disease or metastatic disease. And currently, our patients with nasopharyngeal cancer in this category, this is also a study coming from China, those patients are treated with chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy that we use, again, you're gonna hear the same regimen, it's gemcitabine cisplatin, and this is our current standard. But I'm sure that many of you are aware that now we have immunotherapy that we use in oncology. And actually, in this study, patients were randomized two arms. The first arm was just chemotherapy, as I mentioned. And the second arm, in addition to chemotherapy, the immunotherapy was added. It belongs to the group of drugs, we call them PD-1 inhibitors. And in the U.S. market, we have pembrolizumab, we have Opdivo, we have other drugs in this space. And in this particular study, they used the Chinese PD-1 inhibitor that is not available on the U.S. market. But addition of this PD-1 inhibitor, basically the chemotherapy, changed drastically the outcome of the patient. The patients that they're in addition to chemotherapy, that receive immunotherapy also, they did so much better. And this is not the first study. We actually have three studies showing the same paradigm. So I think that quite in the near future, this is what we're going to be doing in the U.S., that in addition to chemotherapy, we're going to be adding immunotherapy to our patients with recurrent metastatic nasopharyngeal cancer. That's going to be all for the nasopharyngeal cancer. And I want to discuss two other abstracts about head and neck cancer. So it's going to be any other head and neck cancer. It can be laryngeal, hypopharyngeal, oral, or oropharyngeal cancer. And in this study, what they did, that patients with recurrent metastatic disease that currently are being treated with immunotherapy alone, in this case, pembrolizumab, if the certain score, we call it a CT score, is above one, those patients are treated with immunotherapy. But at the same time, even though it's a very, very good regimen, we as doctors, we want to get better results. We want to have more patients that have improvement of their disease and less toxicity. So in this case, in addition to pembrolizumab, there is another drug that was added to patients with CPS score above one and were treatment naive. So again, currently they would be treated just with Keytruda alone. In this case, they added the biphasic antibody EGFR plus TGF-beta. And I know those names sound kind of strange, but this is the regimen that was added. And what was extremely surprising, when the patients were randomized, the response rate doubled, and especially in patients with HPV-negative status. And why I'm so excited, because we know that HPV-negative head and neck cancer patients, they don't do well. Usually they're heavy smokers. The disease can be very aggressive and fast-growing, and many treatments are not as effective. And in this case, knowing that addition of this new drug to Keytruda doubled the response rate is very encouraging, and I'm really looking forward into a phase 3 study or more data so I can use this regimen in my clinical practice, because I think the demand is really high for that. And the last one that I want to discuss comes from University of Chicago, where they took patients with head and neck cancer, and all of them had locally advanced disease. And those patients received carboplatin, Paxil, and Nivo. And we call it an induction chemotherapy. And the purpose of this induction is to shrink the cancer and just to see if the cancer will respond to this regimen. And what was really surprising, what they did in this, that the patient that had at least 50% reduction, and when I say reduction, you do certain image, which can be the CT scan, MRI, and you measure the cancer before the treatment, and you measure the cancer after. And for patients that there was at least 50% reduction, those patients, they received reduced chemotherapy and radiation. And at the same time, they maintain exactly the same efficacy as the current high-dose chemotherapy and radiation. This is very encouraging because we can treat effectively those patients and give them less side effects. And for the patients that they didn't have the 50% reduction, they still underwent the standard treatment, and all the patients received immunotherapy. So what is the outcome of this study and what is so exciting is that currently we offer high-dose radiation, chemotherapy and radiation to our patients, but in this particular situation, there are some where the cancer is highly sensitive to chemotherapy and immunotherapy, and we can give them less side effects, but still maintain good results. And this is what I want to discuss. This is what I wanted to present you and tell you about ASCO updates. Something that I want to mention at the end, that many patients or many participants of clinical trials are behind those results, and I wouldn't be able to present them without their participation. And actually, as you hear, some of them probably, or most of them, benefited from this treatment. So I want to encourage the physician and patients to participate in clinical trials, because I wouldn't be able to do it without you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mystikowicz. That was a superb presentation. Wonderful information about oral head and neck cancers, just wonderful from ASCO. And then also just the your enthusiasm really about clinical trials, the importance of participating in clinical trials, and a call out to all who have participated in clinical trials and how much they have helped to extend and expand really the available treatments available to people. So thank you so much. And our next and our final speaker is Dr. Priscilla Merriam. And Dr. Merriam is Clinical Director, Sarcoma Center, Physician, Medical Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Instructor in Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Merriam is going to present updates on the treatment of sarcoma presented at ASCO. And she also is going to do a wrap-up of part one, which is really going to be very interesting because she's really been listening to the whole program, and she's going to kind of pull all together for you as a common themes. So it's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague and very dedicated colleague, Dr. Merriam.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. It's a privilege to join you and the other speakers to review the highlights of the 2023 annual ASCO meeting. This year's ASCO was notable in sarcoma for reports of studies that added together drugs that we know can be helpful to see if new combinations can give us good results for the treatment of sarcoma. There were a number of trials that used a combination of chemotherapy plus immunotherapy drugs. The German Interdisciplinary Sarcoma Group reported a phase 2 trial of the chemotherapy drug trabectedin given in combination with the immunotherapy drug nivolumab. Patients with leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma, as well as other types of sarcomas, were included. Trabectedin was given initially for 3 cycles before nivolumab was added in this combination approach. Later in the trial, nivolumab was added after only 1 cycle of trabectedin, and the combination was then continued. There appear to be some encouraging results, particularly in the group of patients with leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma. Another phase 2 study was reported that looked at the combination of the chemotherapy doxorubicin with 2 immunotherapy drugs, zalifrelimab and balstilimab. This trial included patients with soft tissue sarcoma who had received only 1 or 2 prior treatments. There were some promising results for stabilization of sarcoma in many of the patients, and there was shrinkage seen in a number of different types of sarcomas, including intimal sarcoma, angiosarcoma, malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumor, liposarcoma, leiomyosarcoma, endometrial stromal sarcoma, undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma, and sclerosing epithelioid fibrosarcoma. The Spanish Sarcoma Group presented results from a study of the immunotherapy drug nivolumab when added to the chemotherapy combination of doxorubicin plus dacarbazine. The results reported here were results from the treatment of patients with leiomyosarcoma who had never before received chemotherapy for their cancer. there was encouraging evidence of tumor shrinkage and stabilization, and the researchers felt that this approach should be explored more in further trials. Another small study of immunotherapy plus chemotherapy in soft tissue sarcoma was reported. In this phase 2 study, 43 patients were given an immunotherapy drug, retifanlimab, in addition to the chemotherapy drugs gemcitabine and docetaxel. Like the prior study, only patients who had never received treatment for their sarcoma were eligible to participate. Chemotherapy was given for one cycle, and then the immunotherapy drug was added into the combination, starting with cycle 2. There were some promising responses, but the number of people treated was small, and more information will be needed about further pursuing this approach. Combinations of oral targeted cancer drugs with immunotherapy drugs were also reported this year. Highly anticipated results were provided from a study of an oral medication, cabozantinib, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor designed to target many different parts of a cancer cell's signaling pathways, which was given in combination with the immunotherapy drug nivolumab. This study, a phase 2 study, was conducted in patients with angiosarcoma who had previously received a type of chemotherapy belonging to the class of medications called taxanes, like paclitaxel or docetaxel. There were 21 patients who participated, and over half of them had angiosarcoma that started on the scalp or the face, and the remaining patients had an angiosarcoma that started elsewhere in the body. A high number of patients had important shrinkage of their angiosarcoma with the combination of these drugs. Importantly, while there have been reports of responses to immunotherapy in people with angiosarcoma of the scalp or face in the past, this study was very encouraging by showing that patients with angiosarcoma starting elsewhere in the body might also have good results with this type of approach. Additionally, another phase 2 study was reported that included the use of the oral medication cabozantinib combined with two immunotherapy drugs, ipilimumab and nivolumab. In this study, patients with sarcoma were randomly assigned to receive cabozantinib along with ipilimumab and nivolumab, or they were randomly assigned to receive cabozantinib alone. Patients who received cabozantinib alone and then had growth of their tumor had the opportunity to then receive cabozantinib along with the immunotherapy drugs ipilimumab and nivolumab. The researchers for the study reported that there were more patients who had significant shrinkage of their cancer when treated with a combination of cabozantinib plus ipilimumab and nivolumab, and that the sarcoma was controlled for longer when patients received all three drugs together as compared to when cabozantinib was given alone. About half of the patients in the study had leiomyosarcoma, and the patients with leiomyosarcoma were among those who seemed to have significant shrinkage to the treatment. Lenvatinib, an oral medication also designed to target many different growth pathways of cancer cells, was tested in combination with the immunotherapy drug pembrolizumab in a small study with several different types of sarcomas, with 10 patients treated per type of sarcoma included. Lenvatinib was given initially alone for 2 weeks, and then the immunotherapy drug pembrolizumab was added to make the combination. There was some signal of activity in several different types of sarcomas, but this study was felt to be exploratory or a pilot study, and we will await what further results we may see from this combination in the future. You may have noticed that in several of the studies using immunotherapy in combination with another drug, that the study introduced the immunotherapy at different timings related to its partner drug. For example, in the study of trabectedin plus nivolumab, one group of patients had nivolumab added after 3 cycles of trabectedin, and another group of patients had nivolumab added after only 1 cycle of trabectedin. There was some suggestion that people had longer stabilization of their sarcoma when the immunotherapy was added after 3 cycles of trabectedin instead of after 1 cycle of trabectedin. The phase 2 study that evaluated the chemotherapy drug doxorubicin along with the two immunotherapy drugs that I mentioned above also used an approach of just starting the drugs with staggered timings. Patients in one group started receiving the immunotherapy drugs initially with doxorubicin added at cycle 2. Patients in the other group began doxorubicin plus the two immunotherapy drugs at the beginning. There was some suggestion that starting the immunotherapy first and then adding doxorubicin later might lead to improved results over starting all three drugs at the same time. As you've heard, we do not yet have clear information on whether immunotherapy drugs and chemotherapy drugs should be started at the same time or at different times, and what order they should be given in if started at different times. These questions are of great interest to the sarcoma community and will continue to be evaluated in future studies. There were several other studies using combinations of medications that were presented this year. Results from an early, small study of the chemotherapy drug lurbinectedin plus the chemotherapy drug doxorubicin were reported from the treatment of a total of 10 patients. Half of the patients had leiomyosarcoma, and most of these patients had the sarcoma start in the uterus. The main goal of the early phase of the study was to evaluate different dose strategies for the drugs, and so the number of patients in this part of the study was small. Despite the small number of patients treated, there was significant shrinkage in the majority of the patients, as well as a significant duration of control of the sarcoma. The study is continuing and currently in the second phase, or phase 2, which is focused on patients with leiomyosarcoma. We will await results from that phase 2 study in the future. Additionally, early results from the combination of the investigational agent TTI-621 in combination with doxorubicin in patients with leiomyosarcoma demonstrated significant shrinkage in some of the patients with leiomyosarcoma. This portion of the study was designed to evaluate what was felt to be a low dose of the TTI-621. These early results were promising, and we will await further results as they become available. There were two additional combination trials of note, among others. Cabozantinib, the oral medication I have discussed, was given in combination with the oral chemotherapy agent temozolomide. Patients with leiomyosarcoma and other sarcomas were included. The number of patients that had significant shrinkage and stabilization of the cancer was particularly notable in the leiomyosarcoma group, and this approach was felt worthy of further trials for patients with leiomyosarcoma. Finally, results from a study of a new type of combination was presented from the phase 1-2 trial of a drug called selinexor in combination with the chemotherapy drug gemcitabine in patients with sarcoma. Selinexor is an oral medication that works by blocking the movement throughout the cell of proteins that cancer cells depend on. This was a small study of 17 patients, with about half of the patients with leiomyosarcoma. There was some promising shrinkage and stabilization of cancer in some patients with leiomyosarcoma, but the numbers of patients who got the treatment was small, so we need to wait for more information. As the presidential theme for ASCO 2023 was partnering with patients, I would like to highlight a poster that shared a research project that is currently underway. The poster outlined two research projects designed as a partnership between researchers and patients and families: the Osteosarcoma Project and the Leiomyosarcoma Project aim to create a shared database of clinical, genomic, molecular, and patient-reported data to accelerate discoveries in osteosarcoma and leiomyosarcoma. This is made possible by patients and families who choose to sign up to contribute their medical records, tumor, and blood samples to the project database. As of April 2023, almost 350 patients had registered for the Leiomyosarcoma Project, and over 90 patients had registered for the Osteosarcoma Project. In conclusion, every year we come together at ASCO to share recent advancements in cancer care. This year was particularly energizing with its focus on the importance of the relationship between patients and their doctors, and how this relationship is the bedrock of all successful care and research. Making sure there is a feeling of true partnership between patients and physicians helps everyone center on the important voices and goals that patients and families bring to cancer care and research. Through this lens, we can focus on the critical contributions of everyone working to make life better for people living with cancer, including physicians, pharmacists, researchers, social workers, nurses, advocates, patients, families, and so many other people who care about people living with cancer. Today's workshop is a reminder that none of what we learn is possible without the openness of people with cancer who decide to participate in clinical research trials, looking for better treatments for themselves and for other people like them. The community of all these amazing people is the reason that we work every day to learn more about cancer, about treatments for cancer, and about living with cancer, and so that we can continue to get better and better. Thank you to everyone for the part you play, and make sure you talk with your treatment team to find out how to participate in clinical research trials if that is something that is right for you. And thank you. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this cancer care webinar. It's a true privilege.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Miriam, and thank you for your presentation on sarcoma, but also for your wrap-up of the program today of part one. So I just want to thank you so much for doing that, for being on this call and noting these important themes and concepts that were presented throughout. So thank you. Thank you so much. And I just want to echo further all the speakers have said, but particularly Dr. Miriam in her close-up, that indeed it is important for patients and families and physicians and all of the healthcare team to work together closely, and that is the theme of ASCO this year. This is part one of ASCO, and part two of ASCO will be occurring next week on Tuesday, August 22nd. And so stay tuned. There'll be a part two to this as well. And most importantly, I would not want anyone to leave this program thinking that you're alone. You, of course, have your healthcare team, your family members and friends, but there also are many organizations out there that can support you as well. And Cancer Care is one of them, and we provide a host of services from both support services to resource management to support groups to our education workshops. The workshops are on publications that we have, financial assistance, and community programs. So I want you to know there's a host of services that we provide, and those are all free and available to you by calling our 1-800-813-4673 or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. Also, a number of our speakers mentioned cancer.gov in terms of research trials, and we'll be sending you information after this program today in a couple of days with any resource information that was provided by our speakers and other resource information that we think will be of help to you as well. And I look forward to all of you being on part two of the ASCO series, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all for your participation. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the meeting. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.